Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is October the 19th of 1982, and I had nothing to do with that date. It's interesting. The only thing we have to do perfect, which is not drink, we don't have any power to do. On our own, without God, in awareness, conscious contact. So that's when I realized that my journey in sobriety got a lot simpler. I missed for a long time that there's a course of action that I take that allows me to experience a power which does for me what I cannot do for myself. There's nothing worse than being in AA thinking you're having something to do with staying sober. That really places a lot of responsibility on your shoulders that you probably don't want to. You don't want to carry or handle. What a fabulous place to have a meeting in. Monasteries and churches are two places I love to visit. And immediately when I go in those places, part of me just... And they used to be places I was extremely uncomfortable in. That had a lot to do with how I was living my life. Funny how you get changed over the years. I've been on a hiatus from speaking for almost 2 years. Dino is a good beggar, so he called in some markers that I owed him, and I said, "Sure, I'll come over and share some of my experience at the anniversary." So it's good to be here. Good to see some of you I haven't seen for a while. It's a funny thing about God and this power. Right around, I'm thinking about 2 years ago. Well, let me back up a minute. A year and a half ago, I was up in Colorado seeing some pals of mine and doing some business, and that's where I got sober. And both my parents are passed away, and I went out to their gravesite to pay respects, took along some flowers, and my dad died first. He died of alcoholism in 1985. So they buried him in the VA cemetery, and this gives you some idea of my family I came from is, not only my mother, but any animal that died thereafter, they all wanted to be cremated and just dumped on top of him. And so there's my mother and I believe three dogs and three cats all scattered on top of him. And so it's like a family reunion when I go visit the gravesite. But and of course, the VA, if you've ever gone to VA cemetery, you got to be hooked up to find a grave in those places. So at any rate, though, I get up there and I spend a little time. And for me, it was a thankfulness, really, to them for raising me and for their part in my life, which was a lot different than the place I came to when I came to AA many years ago. And you know how we live in the second column and it's everyone else's fault, et cetera, right? They'd only raise me different, blah, blah, blah. That sad story that we drank behind for so long. But that left me many, many years ago. At any rate, I was there and I was struck by, you know, they have a birth date and a death date and this dash. And what I was struck by is that the dash is symbolic of how I've lived my life. And that in reality, when I die, this body dies, because the I never dies. When this body dies, all that is ever going to get left behind that has any value is memories of how I contributed and what I did in people's lives, and nothing else has any value. There's no homes, there's no cars, there's no money, there's nothing. What are you really left with? And so out of that, it came a great question for me, is what am I doing with my dash? What am I doing with my dash? What have I done with my dash? And when I look at my dash, there seems to be four very distinct periods of time. Birth to 16, because at 16 I took my first drink. That was one aspect. 16 to 36, and at 36 I was separated from alcohol by a power that I was ambivalent about, which I'll call God. But I'm far more concerned with the experience of the power behind the name. You understand? Not concerned about the name. I need an experience with the power behind the name, whatever the name is. A lot of people have a lot of different names. I long ago got free of getting hung up on the name. And so there's that period of time. Then there's my first 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's another part of the dash. And between my 9th and 10th year, my mind drove me insane and I wound up in a psychiatric hospital. I'll talk a little bit about that in case any of you got that going on. I might be able to save you from that journey. Maybe not. I don't know. You can become so identified with your mind and listen to its talk that it'll drive you insane, which is exactly what happened to me. And then there's the last part of the dash really is from my 10th year of sobriety on. Really, it was July of 1991 in which, sitting in that nut house, I said the third step from the very bottom of my heart, and I have been living that experience ever since. I don't know as if there will be any more segments in the remainder of my life in terms of my dash, in that having really surrendered to the essence of the third step, which is my life is no longer my business. It feels like my life is an inward process, and one place is no better than the other. They're all just a little different, but at the center of it all is this incredible loving God that exists within me and exists outside and exists in you, and all is well regardless of my life situation, which is... You know, I was talking to a friend the other day. Those of you who have some time, because you know, time will shape you. Time sober will change you and shape you. And if you're like me, because I'm in my 23rd year without a drink, and so you have this new person sitting across from you, and they ask you things like, "Well, what's going to happen to me?" And I mean, how do you even begin to respond to that? Oh, nothing much. Things like your life is no longer going to be your business, but as long as you think it's your business, you're going to suffer. But that's probably going to take you 10 years. You know, and then one day you'll quit. Every belief system you currently now have and new ones you accumulate along the way have to be shattered and smashed for you'll ever get at peace. That may take a long time, too. you know, you just... you don't keep yourself sober. You're going to seek a power that does that for you, so you have nothing to do with it. I mean, just how do you? And because when you have time and you look back, you realize that all that is true. You know, and those of you, if you're in that period of sobriety from like early sobriety up to 5 years, well, then we all have our periods of time. We really know a lot, and we really want to impress upon our groups that we know a lot. Now. If you'd have asked me outside of what I said to you probably in a meeting in those first 5 years, how the rest of my life was doing, we don't want to go there. But I had all this knowledge, how do you transmit that? You know, how do you? Well, you transmit it a day at a time and a page at a time, and we're going to start this journey, and that's how you transmit that process of the steps. I was born and raised back in the Midwest. Back in Iowa, I was one of four boys. My dad did die of alcoholism in 1986. Growing up in that dynamic, I made some decisions about drinking that I wasn't going to drink, and that changed when I was 16. And in hindsight, that changed because of how I was experiencing myself. Here was the other thing that again, let's go back to new people. There's a phrase that I work with because it describes so much of me and my life experience. And the phrase is, I'm asleep, dreaming, I'm awake. And it's this idea that I think because my eyes are open and I'm looking at you that I'm awake. And I look at my life and I realize how true that is, that I was asleep dreaming, I was awakened. And when I got separated from alcohol and sent to AA, because I had nothing to do with any of it. And the truth is, if you all look at your life, you didn't either. I love it when people say, well, I came to AA and I did this and I did that. And I think, really? Really? Yeah. I work with chronic relapsers all the time. I have to assume that I'm being punished for past lives in which I was not a very nice man. Because they're really fun. I'm only 31, but they turned my hair white. Because her four favorite words are I know and yes but, and geez, it's just, they know more about the steps than you ever thought of knowing. And how long are you sober now? Well, 2 days. And I'll say to them, so when was the last time you were separated from alcohol? And they say, well, a month ago. How long did you have? Well, I had 3 weeks. So I said, do you think you were involved with your last relapse? Well, of course. And I think to myself, how sad that they've been around all this time and they actually think that they're choosing to go take a drink of alcohol. See? Because my experience is, if you're a real alcoholic and if you're what the big book says and you're like me at all, when I got up in the morning, it chose me. And I didn't have any say in that. And once I took a drink, it decided when to let go. There's nothing worse than thinking you're involved with all that. See, now other people who are in our lives realize there's something a little awry about us. We can't see it. Go on a week bender and you come out of that fog and you get a day or two and you're starting to feel a little better and you look back and you're analyzing. There was one little thing I probably missed in there. I didn't coat my stomach enough whatever. Right? That's how we do. It's this idea of controlling and enjoying my drinking. If one was happening, the other wasn't. We've all been placed in positions we had to control, like if you're going to a company function. So you're looking at your clock because you don't want to drink too much there because you like this job and this paycheck, so you're having to control. But you can't wait till you get out of there. So if I had that control ever, I could never enjoy. Then the other side of it is once I let it go, because of a phenomenon called craving, it took me way past enjoyment. The tragedy of being a real alcoholic is this. This place that alcohol took me to always happened within 1 to 3 drinks. 1 to 3 drinks. I'd be in that place. You know that place. Ease, comfort, present to the moment. You're not worrying too much about the future. Past is just the past. You're pretty present to what's going on. 3 drinks, 1 to 3. But because of a phenomenon called craving, I would go way, 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 way past that. Over and over. And in hindsight, when I look back over my drinking, my whole deal was about, I need to go back to that place again. I was at my home group this morning. It's the Clean Air Group in Dallas, Texas, and in particular a men's meeting. I was reflecting on something this morning. I don't know what it is about us men, but when you put women in the room with us, dishonesty starts to creep into our sharing. And the longer I'm sober, the greater the necessity for me to be authentic with myself and with you is. And like in the men's meeting this morning, there was a lot of authenticity going on in that meeting. That if you ladies had been present, none of it would have been going on. And that's, by the way, that's not about you. That's about a conditioning that men are given. This idea that we somehow have to present ourselves in a certain way in order to be acceptable to you. Because heaven forbid we've got to be acceptable to you, don't we? But that is my home group, and I enjoy that. And I might even be some of you in here that have some ideas about, let's see, what would that sound like? oh, that's not a real AA meeting because it has more than one requirement. That would be a something someone might say about that. And to you people, I say, put our name in column one. Put what you resent in column two and solve your problem because we don't have one. But and I go to a bunch of meetings outside of that, but it's the honesty, the rigorous honesty. Longer I'm sober, last 2 years when I think about it, the concept of rigorous honesty went to a whole new level. So let's go back to those first 16 years. I can only tell you in hindsight how I experienced myself, and I am so grateful that I took a drink of alcohol at 16. And the way I experienced myself, and I'll use a lot of the words in the big book, the fabric of my being was interwoven with fear, and I didn't even know it was fear. It was just this sense of, impending doom is a word we hear a lot, but it wasn't even that. Anxiety, maybe, is a better word, in all places, at all times, and I just couldn't measure up. It was further complicated by the fact I matured very, very late. When I got out of high school, I was like 5'6 and about 140 pounds. So I had virtually no athletic ability whatsoever. That was very important back then. So I gravitated to things like speech and drama and all the great things that is great preparation if you're a real alcoholic that's got to pull off this game for years when I look back. Women scared me to death. Just all of that. Those of you can relate. It wasn't a question also, by the way, of not fitting in because, like a good alcoholic, I was a chameleon. Even back then, and I graduated from high school in 1964, but even back then, you had three different classes of people back in this small town in Iowa, 4,500 people. You had the upper class, middle class, and lower class, right? And that's all based on income, for the most part. And I'd move in all three, become a chameleon, step in here, step in here, step in here. I started doing that very, very early on. Seventh grade is when I started doing that. Didn't even know I was doing that. Survival mechanism, you know. And finally, when the summer when prior to junior high school, I guess I must have just had all the fun I could stand. And to this day, I still remember my first few beers were a Miller, ice-cold Miller in a hot day back in Iowa. And it changed and transformed this internal condition. Big book calls it a spiritual malady. Call it what you will. I just know that something very dramatic happened within me that does not happen to normal drinkers. When I describe the epiphany that I had behind alcohol, normal people just look at me and they have no frame of reference. You know, that kind of stuff happened to them in churches, you know, stuff like that. But I describe what a drink of alcohol did to me and they have no idea. They just have no idea. The fact that it produced instantaneous ease and comfort. That it was a social lubricant. That all these fears seemed to dissipate, at least for periods of time. And that Mark was okay with Mark, just for a while. And you want to take that away from me? I do not believe so. That's not going to happen. I mean, when I work with people, and again, it's historically, it's people with a lot of relapse history, I really spend a bunch of time with them on the effect produced by alcohol. And one of the reasons that I do that is because we have suffered horrendous consequences. I suffered horrendous consequences, every alcoholic I've ever met, behind drink. And I kept going back to drink. Now, there had to be a reason outside of the insanity of the first drink. And the reason that I've discovered is what alcohol did for me and to me. And my personal experience is if I'm living my life sober and how I'm living my life, that does not do the same thing to me and through me. I will drink again, which is why, again, how do you tell this to a new person? The elimination of alcohol is but a beginning. How many of you got like a year or less? Raise your hand. couple. Okay. Like me, I suspect you came to AA because you thought you had a problem with alcohol. See, AA, you all tricked me. See? See, I go to treatment in 1982, and I'm literally dead, you know. Weighed about 250. I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage. Everything I own's in this duffel bag. Really doing well. And go to AA. And by then, I drank so much and I was so damaged, my only response, okay. So I go into AA. And I'm telling myself the reason I'm going to AA is I have a problem with alcohol. Well, if any of you got any experience with the big book, but they're cruel. They don't tell you this till like somewhere around page 62, 63. In one tiny little sentence, they say, oh, by the way, alcohol is not your problem, Mark. It's a symptom. Excuse me? The name of this place is called Alcoholics Anonymous. No. And see, by then, you're right up to making a third step decision. What are you going to do, leave? That's confusing. See? So if you're new and you got a year or less, I understand you think you're in here because you got a problem with alcohol. You don't. It's a symptom. It's a symptom, you know. And the problem that I had began to manifest very, very early in my life in that first dash. And when I took a drink, it treated the problem. And I have learned over the years, if I don't continue to do some things to keep myself in fit spiritual condition, I have a mind that's going to take me back to the only thing outside of fit spiritual condition that ever treated that thing that goes on in me and goes on in every alcoholic I've ever known. You know, which is probably why our big book says, Mark, you cannot rest on your laurels. Laurels is what I did yesterday. Yesterday. It had nothing to do with what happened to me once I got up this morning. You know, when I got up this morning, I did exactly what my big book tells me that I need to do. I spent some time in prayer, pages 84 through 88, rereading these instructions again about what I need to do to stay in fit spiritual condition. And it gives me a whole bunch of prayers in there, things like freedom from self-will, not a bad prayer to work with. Right? If I have to make a decision, I ask God for inspiration, intuition. Reminds me of a whole bunch of things to practice when I left my home today. Because, you know, I'm a single man and I have my cat, Hobo. And as far as I know, I haven't had to make amends to him. So when I'm home and I'm starting my day out, the slate's clean. But the minute I walk out that door and you got my kind of mind, if I don't have these tools in place, we got trouble. You know, I'm starting to pull out my apartment. The guy's coming in just a little too tight. And this mind says, you now have a concealed weapon permit. You could pull a gun and remind him he needs to move over, right? That's right. That's after an hour of prayer and meditation. See? I told you I'm going to be authentic. I'm going to be authentic. That just happened 2 days ago. Right? How do you do that? You know, behind this little old blue-haired lady. You all know what a blue-haired lady is, right? Probably a little older, driving a big, long Cadillac. Speed limit's 45, and she's doing about 20. Can't see over the wheel. I'm behind, and there's another car to her left, and you can't move, you can't get her wrong. And, you know, I'd been meditating, and I'm pretty hooked up, and this voice just all of a sudden switched to, I wish I had a big truck, I'd run that woman over, I'd get her, and it's like, whoa, where did that come? I haven't even gotten to Starbucks. And this is going on, right? Now, I'm in my 23rd year. We are not like normal people. We never will be. Thank God I have all these tools. So what did I do? God, please remove that thought about me hurting that little old lady who doesn't know I even exist. Who's probably having a great day. And the insanity is I don't even have to be anywhere at a specific time. It was just somebody was blocking my path. You know how we are. So you ask God, please remove this thought. Turn, thy will be done. Oh, okay, I'm calm again. I'm breathing, mindfulness. Go into Starbucks, order some coffee, and go on back down the road again. But all those tools are designed to keep me in fit spiritual condition so that it, the thing the book calls a spiritual malady, does not resurface in my life and make me so diseased, so uncomfortable, that my mind one day takes me to a strange mental blank spot and says, let's go drink. let's go treat what's really going on with you, Mark. You know, and my experience about that condition is, quite frankly, it doesn't even seem to make much difference whether my life situation is fabulous or not. You know, if you're a real alcoholic and spending time looking at your first step, my experience told me I drank on top of the world and I drank on the bottom. And I drank when I had the job and I drank when I didn't. And I drank when she stayed and I drank when she left. It didn't matter. You know, there just comes a time that there's a part of me that has to get treated with something. So I took that first drink when I was 16 and it treated what the big book calls the spiritual malady. It gave me some ease and comfort. And I drank for 20 more years. And I am very, very grateful that I had alcohol for those 20 years. I'll give you an idea of how bad it was within me. When I was 23 years old, I had graduated from high school. I had gone to college. I kept switching majors a lot. In hindsight, it's because I liked to drink and party. And at that time, there was this little thing going on called the Vietnam War, and they had the draft then. And what finally happens at that time, I'd switched majors so many times. I was on my sixth year, and I wasn't any closer to graduating, and they said, "We're drafting you." And they did. This is how crazy I was. I was moving toward getting a degree to be a teacher, and if you were a teacher at that time, you were given a 4F and didn't have to go, right? But not us. And so I get drafted, and I get sent over there. And then I come back, and I finish up college, get married, rode off to San Francisco, and I get my first real job in the world, working for a major insurance company as a claims adjuster. Big Bonneville company car. This was in 1972. I'm making $650 a month. That was a lot of money then. In this big company car, me and my wife living in a beautiful apartment right on the beach, Alameda, right outside San Francisco and Oakland. You know, I mean, I had arrived. It was a sweet deal. And in hindsight, looking back, I know what started to happen was this thing going on in me, this fear at the fabric of my being and all the internal dialogue that subsequently goes along with that. You know, that voice in particular, I think, that says, I think most of us can relate to, is you don't belong with any of these people and they are going to find out about you. That voice, that regardless of how successful you are, that voice got active, and I started to have, and now I realize they didn't even have a term for it then, I started to have anxiety attacks. They, at the most inopportune times, like prior to an evaluation of my performance, prior to a presentation to a room full of people. And, of course, that didn't look good, so I had to do some things to treat that condition, and so that's called drinking. And then later that was compounded by other chemical cocktails, all of which were designed, again, to treat this fear. Fear is the biggest thing I can think of because many things manifested, but fear at the very fabric of my being. When I look back, almost a fear and a shame of just being, just my existence, and having to drink to treat that and make that go away. And I'd like to tell you, I know how all that showed up, but it didn't. And so those things, what I would do, I would go, I was working out a lot then. I, as you can tell, I grew a little above the 5'6". I remember one time I go to an emergency room. I mean, I think I'm dying from this anxiety attack, fear attack, let's call it what it is. And I go in and, you know, my blood pressure is like 100 over 70. I weigh 180 pounds. I'm carved out of granite. I got a pulse rate of like 52. And the guy said, "Excuse me, I don't know why you're here. Everyone would like to be in health you're in. I can't help you. Goodbye." So I go drink. And then all of a sudden, seeing the idea that drinking begins to treat that. And just like the big book says, my drinking took on enormous proportions. I had to drink more and more to treat it. Series of events, I wound up relocating to Portland, Oregon. That was the beginning of the end of the marriage. As I began to drink more, then there was the compromising of all my values and all my morals. I believe that goes along with alcoholism along the way. Whether it's not giving your employer a fair day's work, cheating on your taxes, cheating on your wife, I don't care. If you drank like I drink at some point in time, you're going to get taken down that path. Taken down the path, not choice. I got taken down that path. That's the path you go down if you're a real alcoholic. You compromise every value system you've ever been raised with. So all of that began to happen, and that marriage ended. And then I wound up going up to Seattle, Washington for 2 years, and then up to Alaska, and that was the beginning of the end. Lived in Alaska for about a year. Finally got let go. And really my last 4 years prior to getting sober, I worked at various jobs, worked everything from the oil patch to you name it. And when I was sober, I was working as an orderly in a nursing home, right in the great Jack London story, cleaning up human feces for a living. And taking a pint to a fifth of vodka into work with me every day. And there was one room, and it had 8 to 10 older men in it. And because of my size, they let me take care of those men, change their pampers, give them baths, do all that other kind of stuff. They didn't mind my drinking. They found me to be quite entertaining. And that's what I did. And then there was a series of events that, and as I was telling, Jeremy and I were talking on the way over here. I've been sponsoring Jeremy for a while, and he talked about when he was going to come over and do his fifth step with me, and he said he realized later that he had some real naive ideas about me, like I was going to co-endorse a lot of what his inventory had shown him and say, you know, don't do that stuff again. Well, that isn't what happened. Is I let him see through a series of questions, he was like a tornado roaring through the lives of others, and that it wasn't okay. Wasn't anything about it was okay, and I shattered him right down the middle, and because that's what has to happen, as far as I can tell, when an inventory is written in a fifth step. I was telling him this morning, I an idea came to me, what I'm going to do from now on before I listen to a fifth step. I'm going to write the Weather Channel, I'm going to get about 10-minute clips of the worst damage by tornadoes that you ever see. And before I do the fifth step, I'm going to play that for 10 minutes. And I'm going to say, if your inventory does not show us this is what you do to people, you need to leave and go rewrite it. We're not kind when we drink because we're not ever thinking about anyone else. And I was a tornado. When I sobered up, there wasn't anybody or anything in my life that wanted to have anything to do with me. Nor should they have had anything to do to me. Every lie that you could tell, I had told. You know, I didn't realize this till I've been sober a long time. This has to do with amends. And the book does not specifically say this, but one of the biggest ways in which I harmed humans who cared about me, and I've done this sober, is I robbed them of emotional security. Emotional security. Now, I work in the field of chemical dependency, and I get to interact with this all the time. We get these clients, these chronic relapsers. Of course, they're just oblivious. They're just doing what they're doing. And these families, bless their hearts, they're crazy as pet coons. Just crazy. We've sucked all the life and joy out of them. I've had mothers say this to me, and keep in mind their son or daughter's like in their 40s, right? Oh, I'm so glad they're at your treatment center. It's the first night's sleep I've had in 2 years. That's the kind of stuff we do to human beings. And they mean that, you know. And they'll come to family. By the way, just so you know, I've learned along the way, we don't let them talk to their family either. Because they'll call and they'll, will you send me this? Will you see? But I did that. I rob people of emotional security, friends, you know, loved ones. I rob them of emotional security. How do you make that up? I'll tell you how you make that up. It's okay to sit down and make the amends. Big Book talks about making an approach. But you know how I realized I made that up to people? I showed up whenever I said I was going to show up. It's that simple. I sent birthday cards. I did phone calls. But the closer that they were to me, the more I found it necessary to suit up and to show up and be there when I told them. That's how. That's how I allowed them to be restored, that emotional security that I robbed. You know, and I can tell you, right up to the death of my father or the death of my mother, I did not rob them emotional security one time. Really, from the day I got sober. Every single time I told them I was going to be somewhere, I was somewhere. I had a sponsor who understood all this, knew I wouldn't, so he was just directive. He'd say, every other Sunday, I want you to drive up the mountains, because I lived in Denver. I want you to drive up the mountains, I want you to spend a few hours with your parents. Oh, that sounds exciting. I'd say, I don't care. Just go do it. And he was the kind of guy that, you know, it's just some guys, with they're like when they say stuff, it's like, I don't think I'm going to ask too many questions. I think I'll just go do it. And if you're like me, that's the kind of sponsorship that I needed. I needed in your face that look that says, and don't ask anything beyond the instruction I've just given you. Okay, so we go do that. And then somewhere down the road, I started to wake up to why he was having me do. And then I'd bring it up, and then this always gets me too. Then they just smile. You know what I'm saying? That thing that they know. I remember when I started working with this man, he said something I didn't understand at the time. He said, I won't work with you unless you make a commitment to me that you'll stay at the job you just got on, hired on for 2 years. And I said, what? I can't, that's not in the big book, right? Once again, it's that thing of, you know, he looks, he reminds me, he says, listen, let me get clear with you on something. You have nothing I want. And if you want what I have, you're going to have to do what I do. And so I'm going to ask you this again, but there won't be a third time. If you want me to work with you, are you willing to make a commitment? See, he'd know me enough about my job history, you know. So I said, okay, I agree to that. Well, I wound up working for that company for 8 years. Once again, I needed that kind of direct, in-your-face kind of stuff, you know. That kind of sponsorship. I'd be at meetings and he would be at, and there might be 20, 30 people in the room. And my first 8-10 years in Denver was real old-time AA from this standpoint. The chairperson chaired. And if you were sharing and got off into la-la land, your feelings were going to get hurt. And he or she did not care. They really practiced the welfare of the group will come ahead of any individual's needs, and they weren't interested in your treatment babble and blah, 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 blah. This is on the third step. You better be talking about the third step or they're going to say, you know. So there'd be 20, 30 people in there, and I had some things to share, you know, and you'd talk. I remember one time, I don't know, I probably talked, I thought later, only 5 to 10 minutes, and come here, you know. You people, again, that are newer, sponsors lie to you. When they say they want to talk to you, they don't want to talk to you at all. They have to say something to you, is really what that is. It's in the disguise of, I'm going to talk to you. But, you know, I still remember this to this day. He said to me, what's the root of your problem? Well, I'd done enough work out of the book. I knew that answer. I'm selfish and self-serving. How many people were in that meeting? Well, there's probably about 30. How long did you talk? I said, well, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. He said, well, do the math. Isn't that selfish and self-centered? I don't want you ever doing that again. You know, and you go home and you sit and think about that. And you say, you know what? He's right. You know, 30 people in there, and I'm going to talk for 10 minutes, and I've got 3 years sober. What is that all about? He taught me about that. He taught me about what to talk about meetings, what not to talk back. You know, I remember one time I go in there, and I'm talking ad nauseum about problems I was having at that time with my wife, because my arrangements wouldn't stay put. She wouldn't do as I wished, and so the show wasn't going good, and he did the same thing, you know. I want to talk to you. And by then I learned he didn't want to talk at all. He was going to holler at me, you know. And so he got me real clear that an AA meeting is not a place in which I go dump all my personal stuff, that's what a sponsor's for. And if I'd write the fear inventory and do a few other things he'd ask me to do, perhaps I wouldn't have to bring that sick topic into the... But I needed that. Do you understand that? I needed that kind of guidance and direction, and thank God he gave it to me. Looking back, my first 5 years feel like a blackout. Sober. I was very damaged. That's just the way that was. He and I went through the steps. I was probably about 3 years around the program before, when I look back, God even got me across from somebody who really worked out of the book and the steps. I still remember he was asked me what I thought was a very insulting question. He said to me, why do you think you're an alcoholic? See, I'm 3 years. Because we get like parrots. You know. See, there's another dynamic that for many years I didn't realize. And that dynamic is this. I get my sense of who I am externally, which is why, now it's insane, because your sense of who you are is coming outside yourself over things you have no control over, but we're raised that way. We don't even know we're raised that way. That's why we're all concerned about what others think. See? Because if you get your sense of self out here, then what you think becomes a barometer for how I'm going to interact. And I mean, I didn't know that. I was asleep, dreaming I'm awake, right? No wonder we drank. No wonder we had the kind of inventory. Everything that I think defines who I am, I have no control over. And impacts how I feel about myself. Whoa. I mean, one of the processes that had happened to me, and one of the greatest things that happened in my spiritual awakening, was there came a day where my sense of self was derived from inside me and had nothing to do with you anymore, or the job, or her, or how much is in my bank account. And that day I became a free man. That day. My inventory's changed. Those who've been around for a while and done much work with inventory, for example, you take a fear inventory, there's certain fears that'll show up. They're all tied into what I just talked about. Like, if you ever put down, you have a fear of rejection? Any of you? Am I the only one? Yeah, all of you have. And those of you who aren't nodding or lying. You know, and there's others. There's fear of abandonment, and there's fear of failure. And you break your whole fear inventory down, and the reason you have all those fears is because you are defining yourself by an external world that I woke up to one day and realized, Mark, most humans are so consumed with themselves, they don't even know you exist anyhow, and you're giving them all this power. It's just crazy. I mean, you know, my pal Jeremy, who I sponsor, I mean, new people, it's funny, you come out of a meeting and they talk. And you're done with the meeting and the first thing they got to say is, how'd I sound? you know what I mean? We've all done it. How'd I sound? Terrible. Oh, no. And you know what the voices are going to be saying to him for about a day, right? You know, or then you have fun too. You know, you sound great and you watch them just swell up. You know, I mean, you see why you get anxiety attacks when you're due for an employee evaluation? See, because who you are is determined out here, right? Oh, what a horrible, horrible way to live your life. But the steps change that. They bring about a change in that. You start to experience getting free of that. But the question he asked me was, why do you think you're an alcoholic? And I begin to tell him about things I did behind the drink. He took that away from me. He said, that has nothing to do with why you're an alcoholic. Tell me why you're an alcoholic. Well, the truth was that 3 years, in spite of being in a lot of meetings and in spite of looking at the book, I really didn't have a solid first step. I really didn't. And thank God that he came into my life, and thank God he really spent some time with me on my first step, and I got a solid first step then, and I still have one to this day. And there isn't a day goes by I don't revisit and touch my first step experience. The fact that when I take a drink, I break out in a phenomenon of craving. The fact that sober at my very best, I have a mind that's going to take me back to a drink at certain times, and I don't know what that looks like. And the fact that I haven't drank since October 19th of 1982 is no guarantee that that mind today, unless I'm in fit spiritual condition, won't take me back, and I know that. I'm glad that I know that. He gave me that first step experience by asking me a ton of questions. And I'm saying, I want you to lay your experience alongside these questions. Is this you? Because, Mark, if ye be one of us, if you don't have a revolutionary spiritual experience, you're probably going to die. Now, he's got almost 40 years in it. He said to me then, which was a few years ago, he said, Mark, don't ever kid yourself. Very few people ever come into AA, get sober, stay sober, and die sober. Don't you ever think any different. And he said, my experience is it has so much to do with your connection to your first step. You stay connected to your first step. Anything that AA asks you to do, whether you stay sober one day or 40 years, is like kissing a baby's butt compared to what whiskey asks you to do. And do you know what? He was right. I mean, think about this. We all know what alcohol asks us to do. And we come into this program, and what does the book in this program ask us to do? Go to some meetings, work the steps, make a third step decision, make a choice in the second, write the three inventories, do a fifth step, ask God to take away your defects, make a list of all A-L-L, all persons you've harmed, all the money you got to pay back, and go set all that stuff right, and then begin to work with the disciplines of steps 10 and 11, and then take your awakened spirit out to be a service to God and your fellow human beings and watch your life take off like a rocket. And we're the only group of people that go, that sounds a bit much, don't you think? I've done that at times. Jeremy and I were talking. There's in the time I've been around, I've taken all my AA books and put them in the trash can. I'd had all the fun I could stand getting spiritual, you know. And it really doesn't matter what takes you there. I think anyone with any time at some point said, I mean, I'm sure your mind is not much different than mine. You're sitting there doing a meditation and the voice says, what if this is all a bunch of horse manure? And that thought will stop me. Thoughts like that stop me. Yeah, what if it is? And then, fortunately, there's at times a second one that, well, even if it is, the quality of your life's the best it's ever been. Oh, yeah, I think I'll keep doing it. But anything that recovery has ever asked me to do is so simple and easy compared to what a drink asked me to do. And I keep things in that context. Even when the phone rings late at night, even when you're listening to an alcoholic whining about something, even if you're tired and it's time to go to another meeting. Because there's certain things that I see in people that have had long-term sobriety. And everywhere I go, I see it. You know, like the man who carried the message to me to this day as a home group. He still does 5 meetings a week. He still reworks the first 9 steps on an annual basis. That just is the way my lineage does things. Doesn't mean you have to. So that's all I know to do. I know that once a year I'm going to resubmit to the first 9 steps again. They still work the disciplines of steps 10, 11. They all still sponsor people. And some of them have a lot of time. Everyone I've known that has time is doing those things. So it's called, let me think. I wonder what it takes to get long-term sobriety. Let's see. That's what it takes. Getting up one day at a time and continuing to do the things that that are asked of us. Back to my dash is my first 10 years. He and I did that process, and I did have a revolutionary spiritual experience. I did awaken to the fact that God lives within me. Call it spirit, call it whatever you will, conscious contact. Also at that time, though, the big book is very quick to point out that there's a lot of good doctors and stuff outside of AA we probably want to avail ourselves of. And I was given many opportunities in those first 10 years to go see those doctors, and I opted not to because I'm a step worker. Some of you might relate to that mentality. And the steps will do it all for me, and maybe they will for some people. I assure you they didn't for me, and so, of course, I opted out of that, deal. And so got real consumed with working a lot. I had a job working 60 to 80 hours a week, just a whole series of events. And in about 9.5 years, divorced and lost the home and bankruptcy and the life situation. Dramatic changes in the life situation once again. And I wind up at between my 9th and 10th year living in this apartment with a pal of mine and reduced to not even being able to leave that apartment. Now, that was a combination of a lot of things. Extreme PTSD, trauma, boom, boom, boom. All the stuff that in about 5 years, this power tried to get me to take a look at that I ignored because I'm a step worker. And I almost checked myself out of here because the pain was too unbearable. The pain was from the inside out, not the outside in. Too unbearable. And so through a series of events, I wind up in Houston, Texas, and took residence in a nut house for 40 days. Jeez, and I was grateful to be there. That's where, in hindsight, it feels like, to me, that was the start of the fourth part of my dash. Because in there, somewhere around the second or third week in there, I cannot remember exactly, I wound up getting down on my knees, and I really said the third step, and I had a letting go, and things have never quite been the same. I mean, here's the essence of this third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me, and you do with me as you will. Eww. Think about that. Do with me as thou wilt. Do you think that means everything from whether someone's in my life or not, single or married, where I work, where I live, how much I make, how much I don't make, my health? I mean, you don't think that's what all that means, do you? Yeah, my experience is. And what had happened was I had all this life experience drinking, and I had 10 years sober. And I was in such acute pain, having given life my best shot drunk and sober in AA. And I said, I quit. I am done. I am done. From this point on, no more. I don't care where I live. I don't care what I am done. I am done. D-O-N-E. I offer myself to thee. You do anything you want with me. I suspect it won't put me in the level of suffering I have placed myself. Because I stay very clear on a spiritual law. If there's such a thing as free will, I suspect there is. And if free will comes from God, and I suspect it does, my experience is God would never interfere with that because then God would be interfering with one of God's greatest gift to me. So if I want to continue to suffer through my own course of action, God will not interfere. That is my experience. Well, that morning I invited God in and said, I quit. I am done from this point on. What do you want to do with me, right? Relieve me of the bondage of self, the bondage of Mark, the ego, the mind-made false sense of self. Relieve me of the bondage of Mark so I can do your will. Get Mark out of the way. Free me from this guy, for God's sakes. See? Several dynamics going on there I didn't know. My self-will can't eliminate my self-will. You can't self-will your way into a spiritual experience. You can't self-will your way out of bondage. I don't care how many books you read. I don't care how often you go to church. That's my experience. That which created my self-will had to destroy my self-will. What finally took me to the place of willing to have my self-will destroyed. See, there's another little line. Longer I'm sober, there's these lines that have been in my book for years that, without a black light or something, you know, you... See, the big book, I talk to you people, a couple people a year under, we're used to reading books for knowledge. The big book in every spiritual book I now read is not about knowledge. It is a book written to speak to my spirit, which bypasses the mind, because to know God, you got to be out of your mind. So that's why I'm in my 23rd year, and I see sentences that I've never seen before. Read 1,000 times, but never saw it. That kind of a thing, right? But stuck in right, page 62, before you make your third step decision, it says this: with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. Whoa, what does that mean? You could sit with that one. What does that mean? That means exactly what I experienced sitting in that nut house at 10 years. Is with God's help, I can be entirely rid of self. self, that mind-made false sense of self, Mark, and all the things that Mark thinks he needs to be okay. That life that is completely then based externally, driven by fear. That's why the fear inventory is right in the middle of the two. You take your resentment inventory and break it all down, it's nothing but a fear inventory. And you take your sex inventory and break it down, it's nothing but a fear inventory. Sex inventory is about a fear of being alone. Resentment inventory is about a fear I'm not going to get what I need for my security. Fear is centered right in the middle. And the more that I'm hooked up with Mark, the more, the greater the sense of separation. Joanne is sitting here, and she and I have had a lot of fun, a lot of talks. And I do a thing called Theater Live, but it's about the different stage characters that I think define who I am, these different identities. And Joanne and I have laughed a lot because Joanne's a mother. And so she has children. And so she'll call me sometimes, and they're acting up, you know. Now, these aren't young kids. They're in their 40s and stuff, right? But they're still acting up. And so we'll get to, she'll call me, and it's not Joanne, it's the mother on the phone. And she's talking to me, and like, Joanne's gone. The mother's there, and she's righteous, ending, you know, and they won't do this and they won't do that. And I'll go, where's Joanne? I'm talking to the mother. You know, for God's sakes, you're 78 years old, okay? Take a chill pill. They're in their 40s. You know, she'll go, oh, whoa. And she'll wake up for a minute. See, that's the kind of stuff we're up against. We don't even know it. You all have your cast of characters. They're easy for you to identify. This morning when you woke up, within about 2 minutes, you were all sitting at your table. I'll give you my cast of characters. I get up this morning, and we pretty well are going to start out with the spiritual man. He's got to do the disciplines of 10 and 11. He normally is going to be at the head of the table. Now, I work out, so also sitting at my table is the jock. The jock's there. Now, I'm also a writer, recently had a book published, so he got an author. He's sitting at the table. I'm CEO of a company. He's sitting at a table. I'm a sponsor. He's sitting at a table. I got some people that call me a friend. The friend is sitting at the table. The money man is sitting at the table. Let's see, who else is at the table? Well, he's just about gone, thank God. There used to be a Mr. AA. You know Mr. AA if you've had a little time. He's the one that wants to hire AA police squads to go to these meetings that aren't doing it right. And when they talk, they're real easy to spot because they use the word you all the time. And you never hear anything about their story. I had my 2-3 years of that guy, you know. You'd ask Mark to speak. Mark was nowhere around. Mr. AA was. He was going to straighten the rest of you folks out, you know. But that pretty well is who was at my table this morning. And those are the voices. They talk. They're all different. You get that? You see? Those are the different voices and the identities that you think determine who and what you are. And every single one of those voices has different agendas, needs, wants. Here's the tragedy of the ego. None of them know the rest exist. And all day long, you just move from one to the other. I'll give you an example. When I told you that little old lady, I wanted to be in a truck. The CEO needed to get to work. She was impeding him getting to work. See, because in almost 5 years, the CEO's never been late for work. He was fixing to be late for work. He wasn't late for work. If he was late for work, that means he doesn't exist. He's fighting for his life. I'm going to kill that little woman if she don't get out of my way. I fell asleep for a minute. I thought there was really such a character, right? I mean, I joke with the clients all the time when I pull into the ranch, because most of the time, I am just at complete peace and ease inside. And like the big book says, I'm in to play the world, the role of science, and I'm very aware it's a role. So, you know, when I come pulling up to work, my one-act play is called, okay, I'm going to be CEO. I'm going to go have some fun being the CEO. That's not who I am, and I know that. It's just a role. 5 years ago, it was something different. And 5 years before that, it was something different because I live in a world of impermanence, but the role does not define me. You see the difference? You see, if you're, for example, let's say you're in a relationship today. She comes home and says, I'm leaving. If you got what I'm saying, the only response would be, God bless you, go in peace, wouldn't it? But if you don't understand what I'm saying and you think that role defines you, there's going to be a whole other response going on. You're going to take that into your home group for about 3 months, how horrible it was that she left you. And you're going to go through tremendous pain and suffering. Because, see, she's not leaving you. When she said, I'm leaving you, what she said is you don't exist. And where you get this identity from is you are fighting for your life. You can't love somebody. That's not love, you see. So I'm in the world to play that role that God assigns. And I have fun with it. And I shift and move. You know, it's like Jeremy and I coming over here, right? I'm a sponsor. So we did a little of the sponsor role stuff, right? See, and then I come in here and you ask me to speak. So I'm the speaker. It's just a role. You have fun with it. You don't identify with any of it. Allows me to go through the world with ease and peace and comfort. It freed me from getting any sense of who I am out here. It allowed me to be kind. It allowed me to be loving. It allowed me to be compassionate. It allowed me to be understanding of myself, of you. It allowed me to experience the concept of oneness. See? I was telling Jeremy that this morning. It makes no difference to me if anybody loves me. I'm here to love you. See, this is more of that stuff that, how do you tell a new person? Don't pay any attention to what anyone thinks of you. You do your best to think well of others and help them.
What?
Don't worry if nobody in AA ever loves you. You be as kind and loving as you can to everybody.
What?
I mean, it's... Because here's why. Because when my sole focus was loving you and helping you, I got back more love and help than I knew what to do with. Right? It's like if I want to get more money, I know how to do that. I donate some. Tell that to a new person. Right? I need to make more money. Fine, then donate. Are you crazy? You know, it's that standard question, right? Are you, you know, writing that? Giving it away. I know exactly how it works. Give, 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 and watch it come at. I have more abundance coming to me. I even know what to do with. Staggers me. Just staggers me when I let it all go. Right? So if you want to be loved, love, right? If you want to give, it's like, see, I love everything about being sober. I love the suffering of sobriety as much as I love the joy. See? And I love the uncertainty as much as I love the certainty. And I love the loneliness as much as I love the fellowship. Why? Because it's all of God, because there's nothing but God. If I love one more than the other, then I've got this duality stuff going on again. See, how would I know what great joy is if I don't know what great pain is? See? So for those, if there's any of you sitting here right now in great pain, what a fabulous thing. The other side of it is great joy. The extent to which you have experienced pain is the extent to which you can experience joy. I had an experience this morning. I go to the gym, 5:30, and I can't help it. It's just the jock. I can't help it. I have to do that. And I have gotten a little wiser. I used to run, and I don't run because my neck and my lower back are experiencing some things that, as you get older, the cushions and stuff and the jarring, it's a little tough. Finally, two doctors just said, we're not going to say anything more to you. We've showed you the x-rays. You want to keep running? Fine. Buy a wheelchair. I said, well, okay, maybe I should stop. So I'm using machines, and I have a little trouble with the machine. I feel like a hamster in a cage. You know, it's not a good thing. And, of course, for years, I've watched these people wearing headsets and stuff and working out. And, of course, one of my major defects was I want to give you an opinion and experience I never had. So I used to say things about that. Of course, I never tried it. I thought, well, I think I'll try that about 2 months ago. And of course, I love it. So this morning, I'm at the gym, and I really like to listen to hard, hard rock and roll. Because what it does is it takes me away from the clock and gets me into the moment. And I was listening to Creed and their first album. And there's an incredible song on there. Basically, it talks about the prison of my mind. And there's incredible instruments, incredible words, and I'm listening to that, and I'm on this machine, and I am burning. I got sweat going off me, and my eyes are closed, and I'm sure I'm screaming, and from the inside out, I am vibrating every cell of my body, inside out. I don't know, again, the rest of the people there probably were just scattered. What is wrong with this guy? And, you know, and I get done with that, and I'm driving home, and I said, you know what? That's God. That's how God wants us to experience life. That intensity, that joy, that passion, that fire, that turn that thing inside out. See, and that's what this program can give us. It's like that in the big book, it talks about the miner, but he barely touches it and he walks away. And it says we got to mine it for the rest of our lives. Keep mining it. The payoff is beyond anything you can comprehend. This program will change you at a cellular level beyond your wildest dreams. Thanks. That's all I got. Yeah.